Good morning, Tucson, and welcome. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely is behind the glass.
Good morning, Ted.
As always, good morning, Matt. Thanks for keeping me on time on and on target. We've got a great show lined up for you today on December 9th, 16 days away from Christmas.
Wow.
The holiday season has begun. If there's things that you've got to do, it's time to get them started now. Amazon can be a savior, but not always that good. Don't count on anything. Make sure you're ready to go and have a great holiday. Well, we appreciate you every morning from 7 to 9 joining us on The Morning Voice, 5 days a week, 5 different hosts, 5 different topics. A little bit of politics spread throughout most of the shows, maybe a little more on Tuesdays and even more on Wednesdays with Grant Kruger and Food for Thought. And we appreciate you tuning in and spending this time with us.
Getting some buzz
feedback.
Where's this stuff coming through?
I'm not sure. Sounds like some overplay. Well, we'll just
demons,
talk louder.
Demons in the machine. You
know, it's kind of like when you're growing up, when you can't be heard, right, you just talk louder.
I think I know who sneaked in on us. KOLD with their pre-roll, maybe? No, I don't. Well, this is a first. I will figure this out, Ted.
All right. Well, I'll let you keep figuring out. I guess that means I'm going to have to talk about U of A basketball more because we determined last week that it's our Tuesday morning conversations on U of A athletics. We can't stop doing it because the streaks are rolling.
Okay.
Football, basketball, number one in the nation. So now we have to worry about the number one curse. There's always that danger when it gets up there. But the big thing is we're going into Alabama. I think Jaden Bradley's going to want to be back where he started his college basketball career and have a big game. But the Cats, that game against Auburn was truly phenomenal. A team that came in undefeated, highly charged. It was going to be it looked like a great game.
Can you just take one look at your computer there and see if you've got like maybe a tab that's...
I will close.
I cannot for the life of me figure out where this is going.
Totally closed down.
I fixed it. Listen, we're good.
It may have been me then.
The only thing I had
open was the NCAA bowl game page.
Well, there was an ad rolling at the bottom of that one.
There's something, you know, that's
the number one curse. You've just proven your point.
It's the number one curse. It's happened. But big game. Matt, were you at the Auburn game?
I was not at the Auburn game. So we missed that one. I was alternating that and the smackdown that Indiana gave to Ohio State. So that was kind of alternating between the two.
Yeah,
I thought that game was going to be over, and then all of a sudden I flipped back and I said, "We got a game here where was that game? Where was
I don't know where they played the Big Ten championship.
Oh, I know it was it was a home game. It's in Indianapolis at Lucas Oil Stadium.
That's all about 13-10.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some amazing things rolled into the bowl games. We might as well talk about that now. I mean, first off, The quotes from Auburn's coach after the game were just amazing. He talked about the environment of McHale, how loud it was, and he said, quote, "I don't believe we'll play in a tougher environment to win a game than the one we played in tonight."
Well, good.
He also talked about how we had some big grown-ass men.
he said that is
a team on the court, and the Cats played perhaps one of their strongest games. I mean, they really controlled that game. Ivan played amazing. The big men always play amazing. Burry's had probably his best game against a big team.
Yep.
So that was incredible. Number one in the nation. It's well deserved. It's something to come try to come get us. It's a little bit of a challenge, but it would be a good experience for them to travel now to play down in Alabama.
Sure.
And again, Jaden Bradley, that's where he started his college basketball career, was at the University of Alabama, and now he'll be going back to play them again. I'm sure there's always going to be a lot of motivation, and Tommy Lloyd seems to be able to get them up for every game. And it's working.
Whatever they're doing, it's working. Fabulously. And so let's, you know, you're going to go down to a grueling Big 12 conference slog. There's some good basketball in the Big 12 conference. But certainly in these marquee matchups that they've had in the non-conference season, they've acquitted themselves quite nicely, my friend.
And I'm actually glad that the writers and others are taking note of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're now hearing that Miami, Notre Dame, the whole thing with the bowl game. Why would big teams play big teams early in the, you know, outside of their league seasons? Because if you lose, then that's going to be held against you at the end. Mm-hmm. Well, I think in a lot of ways the bowl committee got this one right. You know, mm-hmm. For those who aren't aware, Notre Dame was left out. Notre Dame's now refusing to play in a bowl game. That's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
The idea of refusing to play in a bowl game is just beyond me ridiculous. I mean, mm-hmm. What, you're going to take your toys and go home because you didn't make the tournament? Well, here, how about this? Don't lose games. Don't lose games. You lost two games.
It's true.
You know,
Alabama lost three.
And that was part of it too. That went into Notre Dame being frustrated.
We could be watching their thrilling fourth loss, you know, against Oklahoma.
And Alabama didn't even look good towards the end of the season. That's the big, they started strong. And so nothing.
The criticism of Alabama getting into the, certainly into the top 12, is not unwarranted. Let's just put it that way.
They've set up some challenges for themselves with these championship games because you get the two best teams from BYU. Another perfect example. BYU was 11-1.
Yep.
Had rolled over a lot of good teams. Had played really well. Had a couple upsets that nobody expected them to win. Right. They have a heck of a team. One Arizona could have beaten, but that's another mm-hmm. story.
Taking the field goal instead of going for it on fourth down. Could have been a different game.
Matt's just saying. but the fact of the matter is BYU got crushed by Tech in the Big 12 championship game. And that's what they cited for knocking them out. But then they didn't do that with Alabama. Uh-huh. Alabama barely got by Auburn, which is a rivalry game, so that's understandable. Uh-huh. And then got slaughtered by Georgia in the Big 12 championship game. And they said, well, we don't want to punish teams for being in the championship game. So, as we all know, college sports now is all about the money. So I don't think they'll come in and fix that and take the college champ, the conference championships out. But Notre Dame to get, I get it. The coach said, are we one of the best 12 teams in the nation playing right now? I think they were. But the problem is you've got to look at the whole season when you're setting it up. You know, you've got to look at the whole season. Are there mistakes? Yes. I thought it was impressive that they put James Madison and Tulane, so two non-power four schools into the tournament, both with incredible one-loss records, both mm-hmm. won their conferences. They gave an opportunity, and they chose to put Miami in because of Miami's victory over Notre Dame at the beginning of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Miami was when Duke lost in the ACC championship, Miami was the best team in the ACC. Are you going to leave the ACC out of the tournament?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a tournament, and if they go to 16, it becomes a bigger tournament.
This is where going for that mythical national championship, before you had your traditional rivalries, your Big Ten, Pac-10, or Pac-12, you know, you had your traditional rivalries in various bowl games. And, you know, people could argue about who was the best team, you know, because it was all the sports writers' polls and coaches' polls and all this and that. But now we've gotten ourselves into a situation where, we can figure out who the best team is and have a tournament. Well, because of the nature of football, and you can't, not like college basketball where you can play a game every day or every other day. It just doesn't work that way in football and at that, you know, in that level. So you need the recovery time and the film breakdown time and all this stuff. So, unfortunately, I think we're trying to go for a national champion where I think it's, I don't know. It's tough. It's tough.
It's very tough difficult. And an expanded.
What I'm trying to say is no system's ever going to be perfect. So there's going to be flaws no matter how you do it.
There's always, everybody complains about team 67 or 68 right. or 69 that doesn't get into the basketball tournament.
17 playing games.
How could they not get in? I mean, the fact of the matter is college sports is about money now. It is a money game because back in the day, it's great that you mentioned it used to be the mythical national champion.
Yes.
And the AP, I believe the AP is the writer's poll and the UPI was the coach's poll. They didn't always agree. there were years that there were split champions.
Yeah, sure.
You know, back in the 70s and the 80s.
But, and it's guys like you and me can argue over a beer. No, my team was better. No, my team was better. You know, it
didn't harm the brand.
No, it didn't. Are you kidding me?
You don't have to have this big championship game now 3 weeks. I mean, you think about the way they've extended college sports. And you talk about the problems with the schools like Kansas State, whose players voted not to go when their coach announced he was leaving. Iowa State, when their voters, players voted not to go when their coach is leaving.
Marshall, West Virginia, you name it. All these teams where the whole team is left with the coach suddenly at the end of the season.
And the season's still going on for 3 weeks. Oh, by the way, and the portal's already open. I mean, literally the day of the December, it's either December 31st or January 1st. It's either the day of the Snoop Dogg Arizona Bowl or the day after the portal opens.
Sure.
So what are the players going to play in that? We have players all the time committing, you know, saying they're not going to play in the bowl game because they're going to enter the portal.
And they don't want to screw up.
And it's about the money.
They want to get injured.
They don't want to get injured. They want to be able to sign on with another. There's so many things, and I don't know. It's taken away a little bit from the game. Am I going to watch the championship game when it happens? Of course I am. I'm a sports nut. But they've definitely changed how it is. Speaking of the Snoop Dogg Arizona Bowl presented by Gin and Juice by Dre and Snoop. Yes, I'm on that board, so I can get the whole line
out.
You
can say it. I need a cue card.
You talk about everything fumbling down. There was an article by Mike Leif today in the Arizona Daily Star that talked about the two teams that are coming, by the way, are the Miami of Ohio, who was here last year,
yes,
crushed Colorado State, but they lost in the championship game of the MAC, and Fresno State. And we've been looking at Fresno State.
Bulldogs,
for a
baby.
While. First time the Bulldogs will be here. Number one attendance in the Mountain West Conference.
Yeah, of course.
They're going to travel.
They're a great team.
They're coming. And we were eyeing them. But when all these schools start dropping out,
yeah,
all of a sudden all these rules they've got of where conferences have to go to that, who has to replace this bowl and that bowl, and the rate.com bowl, for some reason, got to come in and pilfer one of the Mountain West schools. They took New Mexico.
Oh.
So that meant we were able to go and get the teams, as Kim Adair said in the article, they'd been targeting this matchup for a while. We knew we were going to take the runner-up in the MAC, and the Fresno State's who we really want, because they've never been here. The Arizona Bowl has been affiliated with the Mountain West since the beginning of the Arizona Bowl. And Fresno State's never been here. Uh-huh. It's a team that travels well.
They've got
a fan base. So
let me tell you a Fresno State story. So I've been to one Fresno State game, and it was Fresno State versus USC, and it was like the Freedom Bowl or something, the Independence Bowl or the Freedom Bowl. It was at Anaheim Stadium, the Big A. Okay, now get this. It's relevant for
It's Fresno State.
I'm bringing it up because it has a nice Tucson intersection. I didn't live here at the time, but I lived in Southern California at the time. But it happened to be Larry Smith's last game as the coach, of USC, because Fresno State came and blew him out. And then USC played the old, we didn't really want to be at this low rent bowl anyway. But Fresno State blew him out. It was so much fun. I just love when USC loses. So it was just fun to see an upstart team take it to them.
Well, there we go, Matt. And we'll put the cap on that as our Tuesday morning sports weekend review. And the U of A folks, best of luck down in Alabama. I think our basketball team's the real deal. So it's time to watch how far they can take this. There's going to be some bumps eventually, but not this weekend. That's what we want. So you're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. We will be right back with The Morning Voice, so stay with us.
Got you some Tom Petty on Christmas, or during Christmas time, some Tom Petty Christmas music.
There we go. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Tom Petty bringing us in, getting us all in that Christmas spirit mood.
Even though the Grinch is all around us, they're trying to take Christmas away from us. We're not going to let it happen.
We're not going to let that happen. We got a great show set up for you today. Rodney Glassman will join us at the bottom of the hour to talk about his second run at the state attorney general's office. And it'll be interesting to see how his campaign's going. We've had Warren Peterson on this show before, and we are open to taking anyone who's willing to step up and run for public office. Civic engagement's important to us. We talk about if you don't like the candidates that are or the electeds that are representing you, then you need to go out and help find somebody willing to run, or you need to step into the fray yourself. Find something that you can do for your community. And if your passion is in the political side, let's do it. So we'll bring Rodney Glassman on to talk with him about his campaign. And then at the top of the hour, we'll switch to another form of civic engagement at 8 o'clock. And that's going to be bringing in Manny Valenzuela, the school superintendent for the Sarita School District. And he's got a lot going on down there in a growing and burgeoning community. So it'll be good to have Manny come in and talk to us about all things in education down in the Sarita. So that's where we're going to go. Know that the Fellowship Square's Holiday Market is coming up soon on December 18th from 1 to 3. We're hoping to have them on the radio today, but I think the listeners are going to be stuck with you and me, Matt.
Well, you know, there's worse fates.
There are.
So, hey, it seemed like last week you were in a hurry to get out of here. You were on your way over to TCC to watch the installation of council members, two new, and the re-upping of a third. And what were your observations of that?
Well, it's always really interesting. They do it as a formal city council meeting.
Yeah.
Because there's only, you know, they can't, one of the things that the mayor does at this point was she gives an annual address now, or address to Tucsonans.
Right.
And I'll talk a little bit about what she said there. I was very happy in some of the remarks she made. But they also install and they say goodbye to the former or the folks who are no longer going to be on it. Obviously, Kevin Dahl was reelected to his seat.
Sure.
So there were two new members, and that meant there are two that were going to be
Karen Ulick finished up her third term on three different wards or something, you know,
She did. And she got some love and thank yous and everything for stepping in and taking on that role. And
was there any acknowledgement of a city council candidate Jay Tolkoff being violently assaulted in his own home?
That wasn't brought
up
in the meeting.
They didn't say, hey, we wish the best for him. And
That wasn't brought up, man. Okay. Rocky Perez, who was, and I think I'm pronouncing Rocky correct. He had stepped in for Steve Kasachek in Ward 6, and he was departing, so they gave him a lot
Richard
of praise.
Richard Fimbres in Ward 5.
Sorry, yeah, Richard Fimbres in Ward 5, correct.
Karen Ulick was Steve Kasachek,
Ward 6.
This is like a substitution card in a baseball game.
It's a little bit of checkers.
Bringing in Karen from the bullpen and bringing in Rocky to...
Yeah. And it was interesting because when Rocky came on, I had heard he was interested in running for the state legislature. Now, from the dais, which was in the TCC at the time,
during a public meeting of a government body.
Yes, yeah. He announced that he is running for the state legislature.
Is that campaigning from the dais in a public meeting?
On his announcement, I'd say that maybe, maybe not, but it definitely dwelled into that spectrum when some of the other members started talking about how impressed they were by his role, what he'd stepped into the thing does. Council member Santa Cruz told him she was going to support him and she was excited about him running. She appreciated who he was and for being such a young man. He was so engaged and so knowledgeable and she'd support him. And then he came back and said, I'm looking forward to continue working with this council and working with the mayor. And mayor, as a state legislature, I will work with you as we combat the efforts by the
Trump. So the meeting was basically a campaign video.
There was a lot of people who understand some of those things that were definitely squirming in the audience about going on. I'll tell you what I always enjoy seeing, because we talk about it. I stress the idea of getting involved on this show, and I will always give everybody due respect if they stand up and run with. So watching both Miranda Schubert swear in to take Ward 6 for Steve Kasachek, and watching Selena Barajas for the first time swear in and with her family all around, it's great because you see it's kind of the joy of, okay, this was work, I've accomplished it. But it did not take long for it to define what the differences in the new council is going to be. Because the first point of order after the swearing in and after the welcome to the board speeches, or to the council speeches, they have to decide the order of the council, which is a long way of saying who's going to be the vice mayor.
Sure.
And this year, both Councilmember Santa Cruz and Councilmember Paul Cunningham both submitted letters to the rest of the council saying, I would like to be your vice mayor. And so they asked for, you know, do I have any motions or any, you know, thing from the floor? Nikki Lee's hand went up and she went on a pretty long nomination for Paul Cunningham.
Okay.
Immediate second from Kevin Dahl. And then the mayor said, all right, we have a first and a second. Now, any discussion? Bottom line is Miranda Schubert ended up nominating Lane Santa Cruz. Selena Barras immediately seconded it. Mm-hmm. The vote went Lane. So you take the second motion mm-hmm. first by procedure. Lane was a yes yeah. for her taking. Paul, Kevin, and Nikki Lee immediately voted no. Miranda voted yes. Selena voted yes. So that left it to be a 3-3 tie. And I leaned over to another elected official and said, all right, we're establishing some things here. And the mayor then was an aye, and so therefore council member, Vice Mayor Santa Cruz will continue to serve in that. But it made it very clear there's going to be a 3-3 split. We'll see what we get from the city council going forward.
Interesting.
Join us with Rodney Glassman when you come back on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping me on time, on target. Can't say that enough, because sometimes it's a very big challenge, as evident by our first segment.
Keep trying to
our
take
first
you
couple
off
segments.
Target, but you keep bringing us back to target.
No, it's every once in a while you try to take it go another direction. So this show is all about civic engagement. We've got a lot of rights and responsibilities as American citizens. It's still in my strong opinion, the greatest country in the world. That's why so many people want to come here. But a big part of that's because we have to have folks that stand up and represent us throughout all of our elected offices. And now we are joined by Rodney Glassman, somebody I've known for a long time. Rodney's got a big background. Rodney, how do you hear us on the phone call?
Did I get you there, Ted?
I now I've got you
loud and clear.
You got you got you loud and clear
now,
Rodney.
Five by five,
crazy.
Yeah, a little
that
five by
crazy.
Five.
So good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today. Rodney's a longtime Tucsonan, a U of A graduate on several fronts, a lawyer trade. He's a really good hockey player. He's an okay basketball player. I'll just leave it at that.
Come on, meanest elbows at the JCC.
Well, there's no doubt you threw some incredibly mean elbows. There's no doubt about that. Rodney's also a member of the United States Air Force, as a member of the JAG Corps Reserve, and he's got command responsibilities up at Luke Air Force Base. Rodney served as a city council member in the city of Tucson. He's run for the United States Senate, as well as the Corporation Commission, and in 2022 was your first run as the Attorney General. Rodney, I know a lot of folks know you down here. I think I gave them a lot of great background. If there's anything you want to add to your introduction, you can, but then I want to jump right into your run for Attorney General this time and give you as much possibility to talk about why this is the time. Rodney?
He just disappeared. Here he is again. Hang on a second.
Okay.
Here we go.
Today, Matt, is the day that, as a radio host, you always say you're going to...
Yeah, I got you, Rodney.
You're going to have these times. That's the first time I had a no-show on a guest, and this is also the first time we've had some...
Okay, we got you back
electronic
on, Rodney.
...difficulties. So, Rodney, I don't know if you got to hear that glowing introduction after the basketball comments, but you've run for...
He said he dunked on you while you were off, Rodney.
Oh, that could be true, actually. I was always he was always a much thinner, faster player, so I'll give him that. Ted's a great guy.
No, I don't want to spend time talking about our basketball careers at the JCC, although I do know the first year you were assigned, they said, hey, we're giving you this big man, but you got to keep him in control. And it was a great year. So, Rodney, I gave a lot of background. You may have missed some of the part. I did talk about your current military service, and but I want to hear from you on highlighting that. Why 2022 you ran for Attorney General? Abe Hamadeh beat you in the primary, and then he lost to Chris Mays. Now Chris Mays is running for re-election, and you are ready to take her on. You've obviously got a tough primary with Warren Peterson. So what is it about this year, this time, that's right for the voters to get behind Rodney Glassman?
Well, Ted, as you recall, in 22, we finished second in the Republican primary. You know, we defeated a very talented Supreme Court judge, defeated a woman whose family started paying the golf company. We had an assistant U.S. attorney in the race. We had a former congressional nominee in the race. And the reality is that if we are going to defeat Chris Mays, it needs to be someone We need to nominate a Republican who's qualified to do the job. You know, as you probably shared in the introduction, I'm a lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force JAG Corps. I'm now the IMA to the SJ up at Luke Air Force Base, which what that means is when I put on my uniform, I go into the active duty legal office, and I run the office of over 25 JAGs, paralegals, and support staff, providing all the legal services for the wing commander in the base. And Ted, as you know, I've also been a private attorney for almost 20 years. So I'm running to protect Arizona's law enforcement and our kids and our prosperity. But the reason why qualifications matter is because the attorney general runs the largest law office in the state of Arizona. Most people, when I travel the state, I say, who does the attorney general work for? And they say the governor. Well, the attorney general doesn't work for the governor or the legislature. The attorney general is supposed to work for us, the people. And that's why it's so important who that person is, because we live in a state, as you know, where President Trump won by over 5 percentage points. But we live in a state with an attorney general that has sued the Trump administration 28 times since January. And Ted, you mentioned a tough Republican primary. The reality is, and you're a pilot, how many years have you been a pilot?
Well, if 34 years in the military, and I still fly, Rodney, just a little bit single engine bonanza. But yes, I've been a pilot since I was 22 years old.
Yeah. Nominating a termed out state legislator who's never had a client, never prosecuted a case, and never been in court as a lawyer would be the equivalent of getting in a plane with someone who's never flown before. It's insanity. And so our job, my job, is actually to get out there and educate voters on what the job of the attorney general is. The job of the attorney general is not just to sue the president of the United States. In fact, on day one as AG, I'll be able to withdraw Arizona from the 28 clickbait lawsuits that Chris Mayes has filed against the Trump administration. I'll be able to rescind the political indictments that Chris Mayes has made against good Republicans simply for supporting President Trump. And that's why I'm proud of the support that I've been receiving, you know, especially from Southern Arizona, from leaders of your business community, from community volunteers, because what we need is someone that has a family track record. Ted, I'm proud that when I travel the state, I can talk about my family. I can talk about where I met my wife, Sasha, in law school at the U of A. I can talk about the fact that we've been married for 16 years. I can talk about my daughters. People know my track record. People know my track record as an attorney. People know my track record as an Air Force officer. And it's interesting, Ted, because as you know, and so many Tucsonans know, like President Trump, like J.D. Vance, like Tulsi Gabbard, like Burgess Owens, if you're a Oakland Raiders fan, a congressman out of Utah, like Lauren Broberg, like RFK Jr., like so many others, like Joe Arpaio, our former sheriff up here, like Rudy Giuliani, the old mayor, so many people across the country. I left the Democratic Party. I left the party June 16th, 2015, the day that President Trump announced. But what's interesting, Ted, is because it's all about track records, I'm also the only Republican running for attorney general that's ever supported President Trump by actually investing in his campaign, by writing him a check. So I run around the state. I ask everyone to consider visiting my website at rodneyglassman.com. And I ask them to donate $28, Ted.
All right. Where's the $28 from?
One for each of the 28 lawsuits that Chris Mayes has filed against the Trump administration. So I said, just go to website, rodneyglassman.com. We even have a button, 28. You can donate $28. You can donate $28 a month. But the reality is, think about all the business people that you know. The majority of the business owners that you know have never written a check to an attorney general candidate. But they've been frustrated with the Department of Real Estate. Guess how many lawyers the Department of Real Estate has?
One.
None. They're all assistant attorney generals.
Ah, there
you go. They're frustrated with the Department of Education. They're frustrated with their ESA program, their educational savings account, or the charter, or just getting a response from the local school district. Guess how many lawyers the Department of Education has?
Don't fool me twice. Zero.
And that's the reality. But most of the business community that you are connected with, that I've been connected with, don't realize that. You know, we were spoiled back in the day because we had a wonderful real estate commissioner. She's from Tucson, Judy Lowe. She used to run Realty Executives. She had a successful real estate career as a broker before being appointed to be the state real estate commissioner. We now live in a day where there's over 60,000 realtors, and Katie Hobbs, the Democrat governor, appointed a real estate commissioner that I don't think has ever made a living as a realtor. And so who can the business community go to when you have someone like that there? You should be able to call your lawyer, your attorney general, because that's the elected official. I call it the wife or mom of government, because it truly is the most impactful elected office in the state. The only person that could have kept the businesses open. Remember during COVID when all the businesses were shut down? The only person with immediate standing that could have filed a lawsuit against that illegal executive order, take a guess.
State Attorney General.
Exactly. And that's why today, Tom Hatton, who's the owner of Mountainside Fitness, who has 25, 26 facilities across the state, Tom Hatton is actually headlining a lunch for us at the Capitol Grill. He's a big donor to our campaign because he's a business person who would have loved to be able to call his elected attorney general to view the law through the lens with which he hired him to view it. We've got an attorney general right now that wakes up in the morning and decides she hates cops. She doesn't think that police officers should be able to decide when they pull someone over with probable cause to ask them for their driver's license because it might be discriminating. So what does the liberal attorney general do? She files a lawsuit, she sends out a press release, and then she asks liberals across the country to send her money. You know, only Chris Mays decides that she hates kids. She thinks that boys should compete against girls. She doesn't think that parents should be able to choose where their own kids go to school, be it charter, private, or public. And so what has she done? She's filed a lawsuit. She sent out a press release, and she asked liberals across the country to send her money. And I'm a big election integrity guy. I think that each of the 15 county board of supervisors should be able to decide how to run their elections. But right now, our current attorney general is suing Cochise County for having the audacity to count their own ballots. And then lastly, and you know about this one, you know, Chris Mays, our Democrat attorney general right now, she hates private property rights. She's literally suing the seven largest apartment owners in the state, including HSL properties down there. She's suing them for using an algorithm similar to what U-Haul uses and what the airlines use for setting prices, because she doesn't think that private property owners should be able to determine how much they charge their tenants in rent. So we must have someone who not only is qualified and will be attractive to the general electorate, but we need someone that when they get there is going to know how to do the job. And that's why our campaign has the momentum that it does. That's why the Maricopa County Sheriff is the chairman of our campaign, along with the state superintendent of schools, and Karen Fan, the former state Senate president, who was the state Senate president when they tried to investigate the 2020 election. Because whose job is it to truly investigate and prosecute election fraud in the state of Arizona, Ted?
You're making me answer all these questions, Rodney. You're the one answering them. It's the state attorney general.
Exactly. And I love telling the story. Do you want to ask me a question? Or you want me to tell you a beautiful story?
Tell me the beautiful story. Then we're going to go to break. And I already know what I want to talk about when we get back. So I'll go back to asking the
Perfect.
Questions. So tell me the story.
2000, everyone says, what should the attorney general have done? In 2006, the Regional Transportation Authority had a bond election. All the polling showed that it wasn't supposed to pass. And it's fun because I get to say, do you remember Pima County? Do you know a place called Tucson? And I talk about in 2006, there was an RTA election. The RTA election said it wasn't supposed to pass. It passed. Everyone freaked out because the polling was off. And so what happened? The attorney general from Phoenix drove down to Pima County with rented vans. He secured all of the ballots. He secured all of the election materials. He brought it back up to Maricopa County because, remember, there was no chain of custody issue because he's the attorney general and has the ability to investigate. And so he brought all those materials up. Our Maricopa County recorder at the time, Helen Purcell, worked with the attorney general, reran the Pima County election with witnesses and cameras, and they recertified that Pima County RTA election. And everyone They may not have all liked the results, but you know what they felt? They felt confidence in the election process because the attorney general did their job. Do you know the name of that attorney general?
Grant Woods.
Terry Goddard.
Oh, sorry.
So even the Democrat figured it out. So there is a way to do the job. There is a way to do the job. And that is what we need. We need an attorney general that wants to do the job of attorney general. That's why I'm running, and that's why I hope your listeners will visit our website at RodneyGlassman.com and donate that $28. And I look forward to your questions after the break.
Well, you set me up because I want to talk about how you would do the job. We've kind of had the campaign talk. Let's come back. And when we get past that, we'll talk about how Rodney Glassman will do the job should he be elected attorney general. So you're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030, The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Stay with us. Guarantee we'll have a good conversation with Rodney for the last section of the hour. Thanks again for staying with us, Rodney. Appreciate it. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass. And with us is Rodney Glassman, candidate for state attorney general. Rodney, thanks again for joining us. I know you've been you're getting out and about, getting your message message spread. And I appreciate your comments from the first segment.
Thank you. Thank you. Ted, and do me a favor, consider calling it the Arizona Attorney General instead of a state attorney general, because I'll tell you, that is one of the biggest issues we have right now, is I think there is a giant confusion about the job. Because remember, the president of the United States gets elected and then he appoints the U.S. attorney general. Each of the 50 states have their own attorney general, but we're one of the 46 states where the attorney general is elected. Elected, which makes a difference, because in Wyoming, Tennessee, Alaska, it's appointed, sometimes by the governor, sometimes by the Supreme Court. But in Arizona, because it's elected, the job is supposed to work for the people of Arizona and oversee all the legal officers in the state of Arizona, over 400 attorneys and 1,000 support staff. And there just seems to be a real giant disconnect as I travel the state, whether it's up north, whether it's in Prescott, whether it's down in Yuma. No matter where it is, you ask that question, about this particular job, it is the least understood, most impactful office in the state.
No, understand that. So I will start. Arizona Attorney General, and the key is, you're right, it's elected, and it has some of the biggest impacts on our citizens because, as you pointed out, your job's to enforce the law. Now, Rodney, we've unfortunately only got about 2 minutes left. So how are you going to go about, if you're elected in 2 minutes, it's going to be a challenge, enforce the laws in the state of Arizona?
By putting Arizonans first. If, as Attorney General, instead of spending our Arizona tax dollars funded by our Arizona state legislature, led by my opponent, on suing President Trump and the Trump administration over policies that I don't like the idea that he thinks that girls should compete against girls and boys should compete against boys. Money should be spent from our tax dollars, maybe representing the Yuma Medical Center, who has $20 million of unpaid services that all were incurred during Biden's open border surges. Our attorney general for Arizona could be trying to recoup those resources from the federal government, which would have a direct impact on that community. That's the kind of attorney general we need. We need someone who's going to protect police, meaning stand up for qualified immunity. So the police officer does their job. They can't be sued civilly, making sure that we have an attorney general, our chief law enforcement officer, that wakes up every morning and says, I protect our law enforcement. Law enforcement is a noble profession. How do we make more people want to be in law enforcement? We live in the city of Phoenix, which is under-policed, just like the city of Tucson. You guys have tremendous crime, according to the people that I hear about, and I'm going to be a fighter for protecting those issues.
Well, there's no doubt, Rodney, you've got a long campaign in front of you. Obviously, the primaries aren't till next August. There's going to be plenty of time. I know your opponents getting the word out as well. So we look forward to having you back sometime in person, hopefully, where you can make even a stronger case for yourself. Thank you for joining us today.
Would love it. Would love it. Tell Katie I said hello.
Thank you, Rodney. Come back with us at the top of the hour for Manny Valenzuela. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass, filling us in on the news, traffic, and things going on in Tucson. And before I welcome Dr. Manny Valenzuela, the superintendent of Sarita School District, actually, I'll just welcome you now. Thanks for joining us, Manny.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I see Matt picking up the phone, so I don't even know if he's going to hear us, but I got to address that. Contraband being dropped into a prison includes crab legs and seasoning. What are we coming to? I mean, it flashed me back to last night. I ate at the Arizona Sands Club, and for those of you who don't know the Arizona Sands Club, it's at the top of University of Arizona Stadium. It's a club format, so you have to have no member to go in, and it's phenomenal. Had some of the best crab claws I ever had last night. It was phenomenal. So I find it ironic that at the same time I've been having great crab claws from the Sands Club, we've got people trying to get some prisoners crab legs and seasoning. Really?
Maybe we could add crab legs to the cafeteria food menu, Ted.
Oh, now you'd be setting a precedence if you start doing that. There may be a lot of other superintendents.
I'm going back to school.
Maybe a lot of other superintendents that might not be that happy with you.
Setting the pace.
Absolutely. That's one thing I think you're doing that down there in Sarita in the school district. You are trying to truly set the pace and expand a high quality of education. We've talked a lot about what your goals are. But I appreciate it. I've got you for an hour. So I really want to take this first segment and kind of talk about your path to where you are. I talk about civic engagement and the value of educators all the time. What got you into education?
Thank you, Ted, for the opportunity to tell just a little bit about my story. You know, I just think people are amazing, and everybody has a story. Mine is not extraordinary, but it is mine, and I think it does tell a little bit about some of the topics and my passion for the importance of public education. So my parents immigrated to this country from northern Mexico, from a little mining town called Nacozari, and they came here with a belief that there's something pretty special about America, and that America would be an opportunity place, not only for them, but for their children. So Dad comes here. He's the offspring in a single parent family. He's literally supporting his mother, his Nina, his sister as a teenager, and he comes here in search of that American dream. Works in the mining industry, and very much a self-made man. Very proud of him. He and my mom, just very traditional, hardworking Americans. Very proud, very honest people, and really raised myself and my brothers to believe that America is the greatest country in the world, and that in this country, although not perfect and sometimes messy as democracy can be, we all get a shot. And so I showed up to the Flamingo School District as a kindergarten student, as what we now have a label for. I guess they call us English language learners. Back then, I just knew that not only was I away from my mom at 5 years old, but nobody could understand what I was saying. But, you know, again, that belief that my parents held that education was the ticket, education was the gateway of opportunity for me and my brothers. My parents had the world of respect for my teachers and what they were doing for me and my brothers. So I learned English pretty quickly. You know, you hang around a bunch of people who are speaking a different language. Eventually, you pick it up. And just really had an unbelievable experience. In other words, that belief, even basic and simple as it was that my parents had, it was true that that the public school systems in America were tools of opportunity. So I loved school. Again, my teachers were revered. I think back from my kindergarten teacher, Ms. Stripmatter, to my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Ramsey, to my high school coaches, Coach John Gleason, Len Anderson, who are still, Len Anderson, I still hear from him sometimes on Facebook. And these are people that transformed my life in a very positive way, and me and my family super grateful. So
I've got to ask, what sports did you play? Because I've always believed athletics and sports team competition is part of growing. It teaches you so many life skills. So what sports?
Well, I tried everything, and I'll tell you that I was a decent ball player. Baseball was my sport. I probably and still love the sport more than I was ever good. I think I was like a 250 or 275 hitter in.
I was in that zone. I was with you in baseball.
But you know what, Ted? I learned some of life's most valuable lessons through playing ball. My coaches who taught me when you fall down, you get back up, you work hard, you pick up your buddy, you set common goals, you sacrifice for each other, you have a work ethic. Those are lessons for life. You know, most of us, even though we dream of suiting up for the Diamondbacks or the Dodgers, we never do, but the lessons that we learn, we take with us and make us better people in our families, in our workplaces. And that was school for me. And I met people from different backgrounds, different walks of life, different ethnicities. And it was great preparation for being an American citizen and being part of our society. So I get done and I, after reflecting and pondering, like we all probably do in those late teen, early 20s as we chart our course, I decided that I wanted to be those people that my parents envisioned. I wanted to be like my teachers and like my coaches and help make a significant impact. So I go to U of A. I was good in science, and so I majored in chemistry and earned my undergraduate degree in chemistry, and I decided I wanted to be a teacher and a coach. I began as a, got married shortly after college and began teaching. I started in Marana for a couple of years and then basically spent the first half of what is now my 37th year as an Arizona public school educator.
Thank you for that service.
Well,
that's given back to your community.
It's an honor.
So from a chemist, you could have gone an easier route, the chemistry, to get your college degree and then go into education. But were you teaching chemistry then when you started teaching at Marana?
I thought I was going to teach AP chemistry. You know, I loved it. A guy named Del Morgan was an amazing mentor to me and somebody that helped shape my career as a teacher. I student taught with him. He was my high school teacher. So he made me love chemistry, even though some people think it's like learning a whole different language. And it is, but it's a good language. And so I got married. My wife and I were expecting our first daughter shortly thereafter. And I needed a job. And my first job was as a middle school science teacher. And I fell in love with the energy and just the curiosity of middle schoolers and the ability to shape them in those formative years was intriguing to me. So I did that, came back home to Flowing Wells. I served as the proud principal of then it was called Walter Douglas. Now I guess it's just called Plain Douglas.
Douglas. Yeah.
Over there on Flowing Wells by Flowing Wells High School. And I did that for several years. Being the perpetual student, I went back to work I got a master's degree to be a principal, and then I charted the course. Again, people that mentored me, a lot of you know, Bob Hendricks and John Petticone, who I think are still around here and making an impact. And so I worked on my doctorate, earned that after 5.5 of some pretty challenging academic rigors and several gray hairs later. And was ready after, I think, 10 years as a principal to take that next step. I heard about this rapidly growing, rising new community that was kind of going from its traditional, very rich roots to a new, diversified, high-growth development route. So I went down, took a leap of faith, and went down to Sahuarita. Again, Dr. J. St. John took a chance on me. I was his assistant superintendent, and I feel real proud to have been a piece of the growth that has transpired in the Sahuarita community over the what is now my 16th year as the superintendent. I'm very, very proud of that. You know, the average longevity of the American public school superintendent is about 4 or 5 years.
It's not always an easy job, and you're in a growing community on
yes,
top of it.
There's yes, yeah.
Lots of challenges. I want to thank you for sharing your story. Because what we try to do on the show is to inspire folks to figure out their path, the way they're going to get engaged. And through your story, you not only told how you were impacted growing up, but you also shared how you then went into that field. And middle school teacher, God bless you.
My mother-in-law
was taught middle school all her life, and you just look at those people, and I know what I was like in middle school, and I go, yeah, that's a challenge.
And you turned out okay, Ted.
Well, I had a lot of good mentors. And it's funny because I, too, can recall, you know, Coach Lewis, who was my junior high school coach. And then I have a couple coaches from high school that I remember. And my teachers. You remember teachers. You remember those educators. Yes. They impact you. Yes. And so for you to grow up in the Flowing Wells School District, which is a phenomenal school district for an area that's not the most affluent.
No, it's challenging.
And it's a challenge, but it produces quality graduates who go on to do things just as you did. So when we come back, Manny, what I'd like to get into is what you found in 2010 when you took over as the superintendent in Sahuarita. And like we said, they took a different path. They became a rapid growth facility. You know, Rancho Sahuarita was booming down there. Great place, great community, but it's continuing to grow. So there's a lot of challenges that you have down at your school district, and I want to get into some of those, how you handled some of those, how you took your experience and made a difference down there, and give you an opportunity to talk about.
I look forward to sharing about something that I believe very much, which is the good stuff we're doing down in Sahuarita.
All right. That's the voice of Dr. Manny Valenzuela, the superintendent of Sahuarita School District. We'll be back. Stay with us on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. So I've been waiting for Bruce to make his appearance on the Christmas music Tuesday morning as we lead into the holiday season. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate that. So Dr. Manny Valenzuela, the superintendent of Sahuarita School District, I just got a text message. It's from one of my favorite mayors, Tom Murphy, your mayor down in Sahuarita. And he wanted to let me know, Dr. Valenzuela's quite humble. He claims that you are in Flowing Wells Sports Hall of Fame. So that 250 batting average, there was obviously more to that. You're in the Sports Hall of Fame. And as he said, you went from ELL, English Language Learner, to a valedictorian of Flowing Wells High School. Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, no, thank you. And Mayor Murphy, as is to you, he's a near and dear friend. A lot of people may not know that the good mayor got his start, if you want to call it, in public elected service as a long-term school board member. He was on the board that hired me as superintendent back in 2010, and a very good man and a good friend. Yes, I love school so much, enjoyed it, worked hard at it, and lo and behold, I remember one day late spring of my senior year, one of my friends came up to me and told me, you know what, I think you're going to be our valedictorian. And I was like, oh, really? What's that? I mean, it really speaks to, I mean, here's this kid who didn't know English when he came to kindergarten and the son of immigrants. And I really didn't know what it was, but whatever it was, I was it. And I remember giving my speech, and I remember just the joy and pride of my parents and seeing that. And, you know, one of the things I believe very strongly in, and I know maybe we're going to talk a little bit about our community of Sahuarita, is thank goodness that baseball is a team sport. You know, I was that guy. I didn't run too fast. Again, I was a mediocre hitter. But if you need me to bunt, I'll bunt. You need me to hit and run. You need me to take one for the team, I'll do it. I'll cheerlead for the team. Anything to help us win. And I think, again, those are those lessons we learn from sports.
And that's how it should be. And that's the best way to get through life. So let's do talk about Sahuarita. The town of Sahuarita, when you went down there, you kind of led in saying, you know, it was a changing community. There was more going on down there. It was growing. You came on and you were the assistant superintendent for about 5 years before you took over in 2010. Now you have 9 schools, 2 high schools. You've got a 10th school, which is a K-12 online school, and you Correct. Also have an early childhood center in Sahuarita. So it's been burgeoning. When you got down there and took over, especially you haven't been the assistant for a while, what Right. did you find, and what were the challenges that you were facing with a growing community?
You know, anytime you look at growth, there is a process of change. And anytime you have change, it's not without challenge or sometimes even pain. You know, and so we were going from a place where the Sahuarita community, which has a very deep historical root, you know, the mining, the big mines have been down there for a long time, very embedded part of our culture. Ranching, farming, we have the beautiful pecan groves with Farmers Investment Corporation. And so, but it was very rural. As a matter of fact, my office sits, which is very appropriate because I do love baseball. My office looks over the Sahuarita High School baseball field, and I love looking at that green grass, and I actually played on that field. And I remember in 1982 or 83, and And I used to get off the bus and think, like, where do people live? Because it's literally, it was in the middle of the desert. And, you know, I didn't realize some of the outlying communities and some of those historical ranches. But you look now at the growth. I went down there and we had probably half the number of students. We have about 6,200 students right now. We had less than 3,000. We had, you know, a high school that was growing, but still one high school. And so growth has been a big part, which is really neat, Ted, because when you're in a community like Sahuarita, as it's starting to grow up and kind of evolve, you mentioned the Sharps, Jeremy and his dad, Bob, God rest his soul, they were in the midst of that master plan development and kind of creating that special place and that spirit of community that was part of the vision. But it was exciting. It was also challenging. You know, growth has its own challenges. And so I think when I went down there, one of the things that I saw as an asset that I believe in very strongly is that spirit of community that's always existed there and that we've really tried to nurture. You know, the town had only been incorporated, I think, in 1994, as I understand it, by literally a handful of votes. So never let anybody tell you that your vote doesn't matter. And
amen.
Yeah, and so we're the neat thing about Sahuarita is that it was kind of like getting to decide who we wanted to be when we grow up to that next chapter. And the neatest thing that I can say about that growth journey, when you talk about doubling the number of students, doubling the number of schools, is that we got to be a part of putting our own patch on the quilt. Down there, we quickly developed something that we call the Sahuarita Wins Way. You know, every community has its own culture, but I remember Mayor Tom and Jeremy Sharp, we were given a talk at the Eller College one day, and we were down there in the lobby of the Eller College, and I think Farhad Mogimi was there with us too, who you know, who worked in our town, and we were asking ourselves, wouldn't it be neat if we could all get together and discuss what we do and kind of tried to forge a unified vision of what we do, not just in terms of how we can help the school, but in terms of economic development. What is our economic identity? How are we going to promote economic vitality? How are we going to promote the workforce of not just the past and present, but the future? And so we set up this thing called Sahuarita Wins. And it's so simple. It almost seems so simple that it feels odd talking about it, but for probably 10 or 15 years, we meet once a month, and you have big, small, public, private, government, school, faith community, and all we do is talk about what's going on and look for common ground. And we've found things as recent and as basic as we had the entryway to one of our high schools, our newer high school, Walden Grove High School, and it's along a fast street, Sahuarita Road, which has a lot of traffic. And we heard...
A great RTA project, though.
A great...
Great, great RTA one project.
Project, yes. And again, in that same spirit, we found that we needed a new traffic light. We heard it from our parents. And the neat thing is that spirit of community and the relationships that we build and the trust allow us to do things like, I call Mayor Tom, or I call our fine city manager over there, Shane Dilley.
Shane's sharp.
He's a good guy.
Really, really talented.
And again, a good friend. I say, hey, we have a common interest here. And, you know, they know streets. I don't. I know schools. They don't. But together, we look at what we have in common, and we found through the engineering and all the public work stuff that they do and the experts that they have is that eventually, yes, we do need a light there, and it would be a significant safety enhancement. And so we don't mess around. We cut through the red tape, and we get things done. And I think it's that kind of spirit of collaboration that's allowed us to do things, whether you're talking about building new buildings. We have two parks that are joint use. In other words, they're schools, but we don't use them at night and on the weekends usually. So they contribute money so we can build a better product so that the overall outcome is better than either of us could do if we try and just do our own thing. And so that's been, I think, the key to forging a community that I believe has a strong cultural tie, has strong properties and resources, and has, I think, not only a present but a future on across the board, from education to just total quality of life, that's kind of moving in the right direction and doing right by service to its community.
So I've got to ask, who coordinates the Sarita Wins?
Well, it's me.
Okay.
So it's school led.
So the schools, I mean, you mentioned a lot of people in the community are involved in that. But it's the education system down there, which used to be, is quite often the heart of a town.
It is. And at the end of the day, school is about public education in America. Is this, I believe, this great American invention. Like I said, it's sometimes messy. It's sometimes not always perfect. It has problems, but you know, society has problems. But our democratic system is still the best invention of governance that we've ever had. And the public school feeds that. It provides an opportunity for every kid to get a shot. You know, I remember when my dad came to this country, he says, you know, son, I didn't want a handout. I didn't want a free ride. I didn't want a bunch of services. I just wanted a shot. And I think that public schools honor that the promise of that shot. I mean, nothing else brings people together in a way that if you came to our schools, you'd see kids from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all demographics, and they come together and they learn how to work together, collaborate, and get along.
Education's the key. There's no doubt about it. So when we get back, we'll return with Dr. Manny Valenzuela. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Stay with us through the bottom of the hour.
Ted, have you been naughty or nice this year? I'll
let Katie answer that question. It's you know, every year seems to become one of those years. There's always something, and it's kind of been fun because having the opportunity here on The Morning Voice to let out some of that steam about, you know, all the things going on in our community and finding the good that goes on in our community and finding the opportunity for other peoples to get engaged has helped. So I like to think it's, you know, it's made it a little easier to go through life. We can get caught up in so much, but it's good to have these opportunities. So I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, on The Morning Voice. Tomorrow, Grant Krueger and the Food for Thought. He will have on Lisa Chastain from the Gospel Rescue Mission. And I know he's reaching out to a couple different restaurateurs to try to bring them in and talk food. Because you know Grant, he will always give you a good dose of food. And if they can't get the restaurateurs, I think you're going to get a big dose of politics.
I always say five-star insights into the Tucson restaurant scene. So.
Yeah, though there's absolutely no doubt. So please join The Morning Voice every morning, either for your morning drive or for your morning cup of coffee. We try to keep things light, but still keep you engaged as a listener. And Dr. Manny Valenzuela from Sarita School District has joined me. And that first half hour was just the perfect example of what I talk about, what's great about our country and great about our community, your whole story and where you've taken it and how you're making that possible for others and the importance of public education. During the break, Manny, we were talking about, yes, public education is important. SLC also supports private education, public schools, charter schools. It's all one. Whatever it takes for our next generation to get the opportunities, the learning opportunities, and the education to be productive members of the society, which both you and I agree on makes up the greatest country in the world.
Absolutely.
We've got to make sure we're making those connections with the kids, the next generation.
You know, Ted, you're so right. You know, when you look at the history of American public education and just America in general, I know we're celebrating our 250th anniversary, where, by the way, one of our high schools, Sabadita High School Marching Band, has been invited to participate in America's birthday parade in Philadelphia.
Oh, outstanding.
On the 4th of July.
And, good for them.
And we know that's a journey we're working on helping to get them there. But super
how can people help fundraise for that one? We'll just cut to the point. How can people help support Sarita High School going back to D.C. for the 250th?
You know, it's actually in Philly, but it costs probably.
Philly's where the country. That's where the Freedom Bell is. That's where it's at.
And it probably costs about as much to get them there. But you know, my first thought of that is, of course, the Arizona Public School Tax Credit, where folks can donate up to like $400 to help with those kind of excursions. But you know, our schools are a vital part of, whether it's public, private, Catholic schools, charter schools, we all are focused upon education, because education is a pillar not just of individual freedom and the promise of that American dream that my parents talked about and believed in, but also the prosperity of our country. The world is more complex, more rapidly changing than it's ever been before. And we need people that, as I say, we need to raise the bar for every student. We need students that have the skills at the highest level, the ability to make connections across different sectors, and that can perform regardless of the chosen profession or vocation at the highest levels if we're going to keep moving America forward. And that's why after 37 years, I still come to work every day, even old and with more gray hair. I love the work and I love the success and I believe in the future of our country, and education is a big part of it.
And I think you do an incredible job as a superintendent recognizing the importance of the leadership of each of the individual schools, but also the importance of having schools that allow children to be in classrooms that are right sized and everything. So when you took over in 2010 as the superintendent, I think you had about 5 public schools.
Right.
So even yeah, it's been 15 years, but adding almost doubling, or if not more than doubling, the number of schools and institutions you've got in education, that brings some challenges. So how did that go for you, and what was the keys to making that successful?
I just pondered the basic math of what you were just saying, is that indeed about half the schools, we've doubled the size of the district, brick and mortar wise, and also in students. And so we've built half the schools in my tenure, which means about every 3 years we've been building one. So we've been working really, really hard. And again, it gets back to finding common ground and the value of education and a spirit of community. You know, we have and there still continues to be a lot of, you like to talk politics, a lot of legislation and legal processing and case law about the issue of equity and state equalization. And there was, I think it was Roosevelt versus Bishop, that was way back in the early times of my career, where the funding mechanism for new schools was deemed not equitable because it was largely rooted on property wealth. So we have a state system that has helped us, and we tap that, and we work with our state people, and we access the money that we have entitled to us. But once again, I'll tell you that the key to our success has been to leverage our community, to ask our community, who do we want to be? We have the state's investment and commitment, and that has basic standards, but who do we want to be as a community? And our community has selflessly and generously stepped up and invested time and time again to elevate what we do in terms of our facilities, how we define 21st century learning, how we define future ready learning, how we're going to infuse technology, so that if you walk into our classrooms, and I am the oldest school traditionalist you're going to find, and I love a good book. My wife tells me that I need to kind of get rid of some of my regular ones in my house. But you walk into our classrooms and you see every student sitting with a modern Chromebook device. Every teacher teaches. I taught with a chalkboard, literally chalk. And they're teaching with 75-inch LG interactive flat panels. And so, but that's been to a large degree because of our community.
Right.
The majority of the schools that we've built since I came as superintendent, two of the five, or two of the four, have been totally on the dime of our community. And we've worked likewise to be responsible stewards so that we manage our debt, we manage our financial responsibilities, we pay stuff off, we spend, but we spend responsibly, so that we try to maintain the local tax rate, the one that we can control. We don't control all of the taxing entities, but our side of the house, our goal is to keep that levy as steady as we can, even while we're reinvesting into our community.
So what was the biggest, of the four schools you opened, obviously the high schools, mm-hmm. having a second high school, now you talk about a community, now you've right. got two potentially competitive schools, especially in athletics and everything else. What was it like opening a new high school in one high school town?
You know, it's interesting because for a while, a lot of people struggled to talk about, they would catch themselves saying things like the high school. And of course, the proud principal of the new high school, which is now, by the way, 14 years old, would say, oh, we have two high schools now. And so, but it really is about promoting healthy rivalry. We have this thing called the Copper Cup. Ed Ackerley, who we were talking about, Dr. Ackerley, through his fine work with the Coaches for Charity Kickoff Classic and to raise scholarship for young people, they came to the return of the quest for the Copper Cup. And Freeport-McMoRan, which is our community, sponsors the Copper Cup along with our chamber. And there were 5,000 people. It was Friday Night Lights, small town, even though we're not that small anymore. It was packed, and it was a beautiful thing. And we promote the virtues of sport, right? Compete, win, strive for excellence, but also victory with honor and good sportsmanship. And it was, that was kind of our approach. We had some bumps in the road. We had a few moments athletically where tensions and tempers got a little bit flared up. I know I kind of twitch when I think about one particular Friday night, but it was several years ago, and we've moved beyond that. But it's about community. You know, I would tell you right now, Ted, if we're talking about kind of where we are and where we're going, we're in the middle of deploying a $50 million bond package, which is totally reinvesting in our community. We are getting ready to break ground on a brand new 500-seat performing arts theater on the campus of Walden Grove. Walden Grove just opened a whole new wing, which is primarily a CTE, career and technical education wing.
Oh, that's great.
Which is, again, a community effort in partnership with, that was funded by the State Facilities Board in collaboration with the local Pima Joint Technical Education District. That's how you get things done. Our fields have state-of-the-art lighting. We have like the best AstroTurf, synthetic, safe turf we can get. And we're investing in our facilities. We have new special needs classrooms in one of our schools. We have a new preschool. And we're building courtyards and updated safe playground equipment. We put safety enhancements such as the latest state-of-the-art Verkada camera systems. We have ballistic resistance glass. I mean, unfortunately, you have to do that as part of your safety initiatives, but we're only able to do that because we have a community where we intentionally engage, we listen to each other, we find not what separates us, but what do we have in common? And let's put our collective resources and energy and time on that so that we can make our community in every way better than it is if we just try and go alone.
Well, one thing you said earlier, and I'm going to assume maybe that the Performing Arts Center is going to be another great example, is your schools, you don't block them off and not let the public get access to them. You let them be used. You share the fields. You share the parks.
Correct.
You know, and now you're going to have a Performing Arts Center that's going to be great for the school, but it also opens up an opportunity for more folks.
You know, I would say we have a really beautiful auditorium. I mean, this was built in like 1977. It has a big copper rock in front of it. It was definitely built before state equalization. It's beautiful. It has revolving pods so you can adjust the size of it. And we've preserved it. The folks there, Johnny Flannery, for years took beautiful care of it. But it's the same 1,200-seat auditorium that we had in 1977. We've determined that we need to build a second one. And it's something that we're doing because it's not just a resource for the school. The schools belong to the community. Last week, there was a local performing group that's been around forever, the Continental Ballet. They performed, I don't know, their 30th or 40th Nutcracker Ballet. And the schools came, and the folks from Green Valley come. You know, the Green Valley Concert Band is another group that performs there regularly. We've had, Senator McCain has had functions when they're whether they're talking about the environment or mining or issues where they're having community. And so this new performing arts theater, although not as big, will be that same kind of resources because our resources are the community's resources.
So when we come back from the break, Dr. Valenzuela, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about some of the challenges.
Sure.
That you see for education, particularly, yes. You can take it statewide or you can take it in Sarita, but I want to talk to you about those challenges and what you see the path forward going on.
Very well. So I look forward to it.
I appreciate all your insight and look forward to Steve. Please stay with us. We've got one short segment when we come back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely doing another great job on another show, keeping us on track. And with me is Dr. Manny Valenzuela, a true teacher in the mode of the song that we led into. So you mentioned that your father came to this country and he worked in the mining industry, 37 years working in the mines. You mentioned Freeport-McMoRan, and we know everybody's well aware of the Hudbay Copper World Complex. What I don't think people understand always is the impact that the mining industry has on communities like Sarita and on the schools like Sarita and the relationship. Can you talk a little bit about what those relationships have done for you?
Well, first of all, you're right. I remember learning about the five C's, copper being one, in fourth grade at Homer Davis Elementary myself, and it hit home because copper put food on my family's table and clothing on our back, and my dad worked really, really hard to make that happen. The thing I can tell you about Freeport is that they have been a true partner. I mentioned Sahuarita Winds, Matt Smoger from Freeport, and before him, Jessica Brack. They were there every month because I think at the core, and it's not really that political, because at the end of the day, what I've seen from that organization is they believe that investing in the communities beyond just the rocks and the copper is a wise investment and makes everybody better. It's very Sahuarita Winds like, and they've modeled that at the highest level. I mean, they sit at the table. They don't just give money. They talk, they listen, they understand. But they've done, based on identified needs, many years ago through this process, we identified that we didn't have a ton of advanced placement college board programs. We had like two, again, historically, and that we needed to change that. So together with Freeport, led by Freeport, and a major investment by Freeport, hundreds of thousands of dollars, we raised $1 million. I remember going with them to Mr. Click's office, who also invested.
Absolutely.
And Rancho Sarita Company and the Sarco and the other industries that contributed. And we now have, I think it's 17 college board AP programs. Examples. We have, you hear about mental health. We have three social workers now in our schools that were funded, and the catalysts were the funding mechanisms that Freeport supported. Right now, we're making physical infrastructure investments, such as in our performance systems, our weight rooms. And Freeport's been there, but they don't just do it blindly. They do it as a part of the community and the belief that they can contribute to making the community better by being a part of it. And so I'm really grateful for that.
So that's just a statement I'm going to make. The mining industry supports our community. It supports our state. It's in our history. So I think there's a lot of folks that just want to shut it all down, but it is what it is. And they do a great job supporting things like the school. So I'm going to leave you with about 2 minutes to talk about what are your big concerns for the next couple years when it comes to public education.
Well, and I like to be super positive. There are some worries. I mean, as I sit here going into 37 years of doing this work, believing strongly in its role as a part of the American landscape and fabric, I think we've switched from public education being an American public investment to treating it as a public commodity. And like you and I were chatting off the air, public, private, charter, home, they've all been kind of part of the American education world. The issue is we're now putting money and philosophy in this belief that just give everybody a backpack. And in my opinion and observation, it doesn't work from an educational policy standpoint. And if you look at the state budget and how much they're spending on this, it doesn't work from a fiscal responsibility standpoint. So my hope is continue to engage. I think idea sharing is the root or the catalyst for creating better outcomes. But I'm just going to continue to be an advocate that no matter what happens, the American public school, as it needs to evolve, is a vital part of keeping alive that American promise that my mom and dad believed in when they came across the border from Mexico, immigrated, and became a part of our society. So I'm still excited to get to work every day, and I look forward to keep doing it.
1 minute. Any growth plans in Sarita?
Growth plans in Sarita?
For schools.
For us, we're at this point, our plan is for the next couple of years to continue to finish these big bond programs, which still include additional facilities. Like I said, we're wrapping up classrooms at one of our schools, a preschool at one of our schools, additional facilities enhancements, mostly amenities and sports and fine arts facilities. And we just look forward to that being just a stepping stone in partnership with our town and community to more great things to come.
Well, I'm sure your work will continue to be cut out for you. Sarita's still growing. Mayor Murphy, his council, there's a lot of opportunity in that part of Arizona. And I know that it will be driven by the success of your school district.
Well, thank you. Success is like I said, success is a team sport, and we look forward to doing more great things together.
I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Voice. Stay with us for Win Tucson with Kathleen Wynn after this. And always turn into 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Have a great week, everybody.